All right. Hey, welcome back to the podcast. You may have heard me say, or I have said, that America is having a very silly conversation about race in order to avoid having a serious, substantive conversation about race. We're too busy counting who's white, who's black, who's this, who's that, counting the color of faces. We're too busy shaming people for things they can't control. We can't control our race, our ethnicity. We can't control our gender. Well, some people say, and perhaps you can in certain cases. I don't know. But there is an insane conversation happening. And I think what's going on at Smith College is a perfect example of the lunacy of the moment. Are you familiar with this situation? Let me try to bring you up to speed if you're not. A couple of months ago, I was laying around the house and I saw an article in the New York Times. I actually do not like the Times. I do glance at it. It doesn't speak to me very often at all. The paper has radically changed over the past 2 or 3 years. But this story, I knew the author, the writer, Michael Powell. Met him once or twice years ago. We're not friends or anything like that, but I read it, and it deeply moved me, and let me read you a portion of it, and then we'll have a conversation with Jody Shaw. Jody Shaw is a former residential life worker at Smith College, and she also worked at the library there. She's a Smith College graduate. She is a brilliant person, as you will soon realize and notice. Her life was turned upside down by the turmoil on that campus as it tries to, I don't know, outwoke itself and shame white people about ridiculous stuff. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, the New York Times story is, let's see here, February 24th, 2021, Northampton, Massachusetts. In midsummer of 2018, Umu Kunute, a black student at Smith College, recounted a distressing American tale. She was eating lunch in a dorm room when a janitor and a campus police officer walked over and asked her what she was doing there. The officer, who could have been carrying a lethal weapon, left her near meltdown, Ms. Kunute wrote on her Facebook page, saying that this encounter continued a year-long pattern of harassment at Smith. "All I did was be black," Ms. Kunute wrote. "It's outrageous that some people question my being at Smith College and my existence overall as a woman of color." The college's president, Kathleen McCartney, offered profuse apologies and put the janitor on paid leave. "This painful incident reminds us of the ongoing legacy of racism and bias," the president wrote, "in which people of color are targeted while simply going about their ordinary lives." The New York Times, The Washington Post, and CNN picked up the story of a young female student harassed by white workers. The American Civil Liberties Union, which took the student's case, said she was profiled for eating while black. Less attention was paid 3 months later when a law firm hired by Smith College to investigate the episode found no persuasive evidence of bias. Ms. Kunute was determined to have eaten in a deserted dorm that had been closed for the summer. The janitor had been encouraged to notify security if he saw unauthorized people there. The officer, like all campus police, was unarmed. Smith College officials emphasized reconciliation and healing after the incident. In the months to come, they announced a raft of anti-bias training for all staff, a revamped and more sensitive campus police force, and the creation of dormitories, as demanded by Ms. Kunute and her ACLU lawyer, set aside for black students and other students of color. But they did not offer any public apology or amends to the workers whose lives were gravely disrupted by the student's accusation. This is a tale of how race, class, and power collided at the elite 145-year-old liberal arts college, where tuition, room, and board top $78,000 a year, and where the employees who keep the school running often come from working-class enclaves beyond the school's elegant wrought iron gates. The story highlights the tensions between a student's deeply felt sense of personal truth and facts that are at odds with it. The tensions come at a time when few in the Smith community feel comfortable publicly questioning liberal orthodoxy on race and identity, and some professors worry the administration is too deferential to its increasingly emboldened students. Well, that's a portion of the story. It goes on quite a bit longer. It's fascinating. It's very well done, well written, and I highly recommend it. I'll try to put a link to it on the podcast webpage. So one person whose life was turned upside down by the training that came afterwards was our guest, Jody Shaw. You can learn more about her on her website, which I would like to just mention here. It's jodyshaw.net, JODISHAW.net, Jody with an I, Shaw.net. Her life is, well, she'll characterize it in a moment, but she was enjoying herself. It was a different experience than when she was a student there. The place had changed a great deal. After this incident, you heard a moment ago from Michael Powell the story. They initiated all of this sensitivity training and racial awareness, and a lot of it sounds to me like it was totally wrong-headed and toxic, and real people paid a price for this stuff. So I'm excited to bring you this conversation with my new friend, Jody Shaw. The media stuff you've done, is it a distraction? I know people, not you, but some people can get hooked on it. And it's like, you get some attention, you get, and people facilitate it and it's all great. And you get on Tucker, but at the end of the day, these doesn't really provide income, as you know. And, it doesn't really, you might get more followers, but it doesn't go anywhere. I'm not really talking about you, but you see that, do you see it as a trap?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. You know, this is interesting you bring this up, Greg, because I've been watching this, you know, of course, in my own case and with others now that I've gotten to know in this, I guess, for lack of a better word, this world or this third space, the politically homeless, the cancel culture victims, culture war victims, who, you know, whistleblowers, they come out and then they get podcasted to death, and basically get their content, right? And it became clear to me pretty early on, like, that was what was going on. And it was fine because it did help me. It did help me raise money. It helped me get supporters and feel like it helped me find a community that I now have. It helped me find friends. So it's been very, very good. But I also start to wonder about the underpinnings of it, such as people who are not, and a lot of, most podcasters are small, you know, like they're doing it on the side or whatever. And for those kinds of things, I think it's beneficial for connections, you know, and friends and community. But there are some people who are rather large and making some cases, if you're talking about Substack, could be millions of dollars. And a friend of mine proposed that when a whistleblower comes up and, for example, might need legal help or other resources because they just lost their job, that perhaps there should be a tax on the person's who's, you know, writing the Substack, or the person who's doing the podcast, if they're big enough, and or they make a donation to the person's legal fund or something, which I thought was interesting, because in that scenario, yeah, I don't know, it's hard to gauge what's God, sorry, I hope you're egging
it. No, I get it. I get it.
You know what I mean? You become content, and then you feel like, in some cases, I know some people feel like kind of cast off. Like that's where the support ends. It wasn't really support. It was just that you were needed for content. That can be the feeling. But we know how the world works, right? Like that's kind of how the world works. But for me, I got really exhausted. And I know other people do, just talking about doing the so many interviews, and it was kind of a relief not to be doing so many all the time anymore. And honestly, this is nice because, I mean, I want to talk about Smith with you, but it's nice to talk about other things. So I don't know. It's been okay. I mean, there's other things that I'm doing now that I'd love to talk about more than just the Smith College story, because it kind of feels like beating a dead horse at this point.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Podcasting to death. That's I don't know if you coined that, but that's a danger. Really,
podcast to death. Somebody also calls it the chattering class. A friend of mine.
That's been around for a while. Okay. That's Nixonian.
So he didn't. That's what Nixonian.
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely evolved, the chattering class, with the advent of social media and the internet.
Everyone's chatting. And then I guess I was cognizant of this when I reached out to you first, because I knew that I think I was the one, I said something about you might be reluctant to do conservative media or...
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, thank you.
Not anymore. No, because now I've gotten really clear on that. That was a big deal at first. Like, don't go on this person's show. Don't go on this person's show. It's like, well, basically, so there's nobody's show to go on because there's no platform on the left. And so, but I got real clear about that. Like, I feel free now of those concerns, because I really feel like the left-right distinctions are completely meaningless at this point, completely irrelevant. I can see that very, very clearly, that we have authoritarianism, or you could even call it the advent of totalitarianism. And when authoritarianism comes to town, if we want any hope of not having it take over, then we really need to link arms. All other distinctions are meaningless. In fact, they are a luxury of a functioning democracy. And I would say our democracy is breaking down quite rapidly. And so therefore, this clinging to left-right is just, I mean, in fact, that's part of how the authoritarianism works, right? Is this extreme divide, and then it just sucks into this vacuum. Like, remember policy debates and stuff? Remember we used to talk about policy, like universal health care and tax codes and like all those things? I feel like I'm willing to put aside my policy. I'm not even a very political person, so maybe it's no big sacrifice for me, but I'm willing to put aside those things and link arms right now, because I think this is the most pressing issue facing our country.
And
frankly,
are there other people like you? Now you've spoken out and you talked about the conservative community, but are there prominent, you don't have to name them, of course, but prominent liberals or not so prominent liberals, people like you who are saying, thank you, stop the insanity, let's do this, from the left? From the left?
Yes, I'm meeting more and more. Yeah, but here's the thing. Yes, here's the thing. They don't stay on the – they start to say, well, I'm not on the left anymore. And again, because it's meaningless, really. And the reason I say I'm on the left and I'm liberal, because if we were adhering to those old distinctions, I still am liberal. Like, I want universal health care. I do want X, Y, and Z that is a traditionally liberal stance. But I found that most people don't even want to be associated anymore with the liberals or the left. I have met a lot of people who are like talking about classical liberalism, you know, which really is the foundation of conservative as well, right? I mean, isn't that like the whole thing, like freedom of speech and freedom of the press and, well, that, wait, yeah, not freedom of the press, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? All those liberal values, like live and let live kind of stuff. And, you know, I have a right to think how I want to think and you think how you want to think. And we argue through things using reason and logic. Those are enlightenment values, I guess. I guess liberalism is an enlightenment value, isn't it?
I
think about it. Isn't it?
Yeah, I know.
Universal liberalism. It's okay. We don't have to.
I wish I had this conversation 10 years ago, or maybe when I was 23, I could have spoken. I could have said something that would have added to what you just said.
You mean like right when you graduated from college and you just read all the books?
Yeah. gosh, what am I reading now? Nothing. Nothing of the kind. So look, I do want to ask you about that, and we talked about this the last time, but that video. I know you made a bunch, but there's one where you're like, this is not okay. And you're sitting there and you've got this skull cap on or whatever it is. And you look like, you know, you look like this Brooklyn hipster. And it was so cool because, I was kind of going through something weird and everybody's sensing this oddness. And it looked like it was from a movie from the future about what's happening now. It was too perfect. I don't know if you've gotten that reaction. That probably not. But there was something incredible. The energy of it was just mind-blowing. Very, very special. Tell us a little bit about that moment. And forgive my over-the-top reaction, but...
Wow, I love your over-the-top reaction. I have not had that analysis. Thank you, Greg.
So you had this battle on your hands. We'll get to that later, but you sat down and you tell us what happened.
Yeah, so the first video I was not wearing the cap. It's really interesting now because nobody's ever watched all the videos, but when I made the first video, I wasn't wearing the cap and everything in my room was covered with like red velvet because I was so scared somebody would see something in my room, you know, like see something and pull it out and say, look, she has this notebook, you know, and it has a swear word on it or something. And as the videos progress, like I gradually start removing the velvet. It's really interesting. And then I started wearing the beanie pretty soon, just because I always have worn one from my Brooklyn hipster days, Greg. So that's pretty good. So I think like in terms of the style and design, I think it's like just me becoming more honest about who I am, really. And that's what the beanie's about. I mean, I wear a beanie like all the time, probably in the summer. Even my kids do. It's I don't know what it is. It's like a genetic abnormality or something. Or mutation.
Well, I mean, it was, I'm not saying like, oh my God, she's wearing a beanie and she looks like a hipster. It was more like, it was just, I almost noticed it later. It was the power of your message from someone like you. And there was I had only been hearing that from, and I hate when white guys put down other white guys by saying white guys, but you know, by a certain crew.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean. By somebody just who's like this average person, you mean? Like,
yeah,
somebody not an academic, not part of the chattering class, not faculty, not polished at all.
Well, it was pretty polished. It's effective. I mean, you're remarkably eloquent and you're, and it's powerful. It's actually that you had all the, and I didn't necessarily notice this right away, but that you were coming from the left. That coupled with the power of your message was great.
Yeah.
I
look like I come from the left, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, the packaging. Did you hear about this woman, this girl who grew up in North Korea and defected and went to Colombia?
I have heard about her. I haven't watched her. She made a video, right?
She wrote a book
recently.
She was interviewed, I think, might have been on Tucker. And I interviewed her this week. It was on the show, the TV show. And there was something kind of cool about it in a different way. I mean, here's this, and, you know, forgive me. She's Asian, very high-end Asian. You know, I see these tourists with, you know, ultra deluxe handbags and all that stuff that goes with it. And that's what she looks like. And she's talking about the oppression at Columbia University and her love of Jane Austen and how they ridiculed her for that. And I just, people coming from all walks of life, whether they're black or Muslim, Tatiana Ibrahim coming forward, those school board moms, you know?
Yeah. It's powerful, isn't it?
It is powerful. It's quite a moment. And so, but you were the first that I quite frankly... I mean, yeah, you're like the Paul Revere. There was something, that's it. You were the first. Now it's happening a lot. But back then, I mean, it's not that long ago. It's a few months ago. But to me, you struck me as the first.
I felt very alone. I guess I didn't really think about that, huh? I didn't see anyone who looked like me, Greg. But I did it anyway.
real quick, you are from New Hampshire originally, right?
Yeah, I mostly grew up in New Hampshire, but we moved around a lot. And we ended up in New Hampshire in my middle school years. And then stayed there. Yeah, my dad had a diner and worked in the diner. And Then I went to Smith College.
Now you you said you were like kind of an average so-so, average student in high school, which immediately like, wait a second, Smith is ultra competitive and high end, but not so much back then.
Yeah, that's a good, well, it was still kind of competitive, not as much, but I was a unique, weird case. I almost dropped out of high school and I ended up, the principal, to his credit, let me leave every day at 11 a.m. my junior year to do, quote, independent study, end quote, which I did. You know, I went to the library a lot on my own by myself because otherwise I was going to drop out. And then I had a crush on my English teacher, like a major crush. So my senior year, I went back all day and got straight A's because I had such a crush on my English teacher.
It wasn't reciprocated.
No.
Okay.
And it was a she. And her daughter went to Smith. And so I was like, well, I want to go to Smith too. Like, I feel like when I look, most of my decisions in life are, maybe this is true for everybody, but a lot of mine are driven by non-conventional reasons. Like,
totally.
Well, maybe for guys too. Like, why do guys play guitar to pick up girls? You know, I mean, it's not really about the guitar so much as it is about trying to get the girl.
I went to the college I picked was because I liked some girl who I talked to twice in my life, and she was a year ahead of me. I went to that college because she went there. I mean,
I said see.
Wait, oh,
I
you
said,
see.
See. Sorry.
I thought you were.
I said see. Yeah, I think that's probably, if people went back and examined their lives, they'd probably see that like a lot of those decisions that they made, like why they moved somewhere or why they took this job or went to this school, like there's like other people involved. Maybe that's not true for everybody, but I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, there are kind of irrational things that kick in. So wait, all right.
Irrational,
so
yeah.
You are, so Smith,
oh,
you
so
loved.
I got into Smith. I got into Smith, yeah.
And you loved it there.
I did love it there. And I mostly got in because I was a very good athlete, and the coach, even though it's NCAA Division III, the coach, I was waitlisted actually. And the coach really pushed for me. I mean, in fact, he said I was number one on the athletic list of all the sports. And so he was at the admissions office every day, calling me every day. So
what sport?
Swimming.
Wow.
Yeah. So I got there and I did pretty well. My first year, I got on Dean's list. Second year, did great. Went all American my second year in swimming. I was very heavily involved. And then by the third year, I started to feel a little stifled. I mean, remember, Smith is small. It's in a small town. It's a residential college, so everyone lives on campus with few exceptions. And again, just like high school, by junior year, I was like, I'm getting bored. And so senior year, I moved off campus. And that kind of kept me in school, although I didn't do quite as well my senior year. So I was never like a stellar student, I guess, you know, as kind of person, if I applied myself, I could do great things, but I was more interested in experiences and, you know, growth and people and arts type stuff.
And what was your major?
Cultural anthropology.
So you graduate, and I'm sorry, what year? 93, 94?
93, yeah.
And this
When
starts,
did you graduate?
91.
Oh, okay.
And I did not take advantage of college at all. I just, gosh, such a ridiculous waste of time for me. I mean, no, you worry about the dumbest things. And I was, I shouldn't talk about myself, but you know what happened?
Well, youth is wasted on the young, right?
Yeah, right. We're not sure. the worst thing that ever happened to me, it wasn't terrible, but I was in a political science class, and this is in the first semester, and I had this extended debate with this teacher in front of everybody else, and it happened by accident, and it was about Andrei Gromyko, who was at the time, I think, the president of the Soviet Union, and we're arguing this fine point, not arguing, it's not heated, but I was right on a point, and I knew she was wrong, and we just kind of kept going back and forth, and finally she said, oh, you're correct. I stand corrected. And I felt so great, but I also It's so weird. I got straight A's my first semester, and this is right at the end of the first semester. I lost all interest in school after that. I'm like, these people have nothing to offer me. Isn't that stupid? It's just the most immature reaction ever. I was 18, so you can make these mistakes. So I'm like, these people suck. And I just felt,
I thought I understand that at 18 though.
Yeah, I guess. But, and then I just kind of, you know, I lost interest in school. I got through it. I got through it actually earlier. Anyway, I did fine, but it was, so you leave Smith and then you kind of, you adopt a, you don't go to corporate America, obviously. You do a lot of alternative type things.
Yes. Alternative type things. There you go.
Where did you go first?
Well, I got in a car and I didn't know where I was going to go. I had a girlfriend at the time and we just started driving. We thought we wanted to go to Santa Fe. She had this, like, I want to live in Santa Fe. But, you know, we got there and it was like, oh, this is kind of a small town. And like, I don't know that we would get, and there's any jobs here besides working at CVS or. So we kept driving. We went to LA. I really liked LA. She did not. We went up to San Francisco. San Francisco was overwhelming. And so we thought, well, I guess the only place that's left if we keep driving north is Seattle. So I was like, okay, I guess we're going to move to Seattle. And we stopped for one night in Portland, Oregon. And I stayed there for 5 years. And this was in the golden era of Portland. I don't know if you've, like, Portlandia land.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this last time. Where you didn't have to have a car. I mean, for a young person in their 20s, it was who's like super liberal, you know, smokes pot, you know, and doesn't, I'm not fond of cars. I never have been. And there was public transportation and you could live right near downtown. I mean, I had a one bedroom apartment for $300 a month, right near the river, the Willamette River. It was paradise. I mean, it was almost like extended campus college playground, but without the classes, you know, that's what it felt like. And, you know, I was working just various wage earner jobs and had plenty of money. You know, I was living hand to mouth, but I never like was in need of food or pot or anything like that. You know, I was living the life. It was great. And then I was writing this whole time. I wanted to be a writer, really. I mean, I had ambitions to be a poet specifically.
Oh my. I mean, I mean, sorry. It's just like to be a poet. I mean, it's beautiful. It's like, it's what to be a, I mean, a published, to survive as a poet is, well, it's tough. I mean, it's tough. No, it's fun. It's fun. It's that lifestyle.
It was that lifestyle, Greg. Everything you imagine, it was that lifestyle.
No, I mean, look, I'm envious. I mean, you know, while you're up there, I was in the Marine Corps.
You know, thank you for your service, so that I could run around Portland being a poet. I really appreciate it.
Tell us about some of the jobs you had, just real quick.
Oh God, I worked. Let's see, as a lifeguard, I worked as a cook, a line cook in a restaurant. I worked in a homeless shelter, a shelter for homeless women and domestic violence survivors and their children. I worked, I delivered newspapers. Those are some of the things I did in Portland. I worked in a number of restaurants.
And you're not an outlier in terms of like, okay, you're highly educated. No, you're outlier in the Portland scene. There are a lot of people with
highly
educated,
degrees,
right?
Yes,
doing similar things,
just floating around, floating around, just kind of being or existing. I mean, that's Portlandia, you know.
Yeah,
just kind of, living. Wait. I guess. Oh, and then I did get a real job. We talked about this last time. Mm-hmm. I did get it. Quote unquote, not that those aren't real jobs, but you know what I mean? Like a professional track job, I guess you would call it, or a career job. I was working, I thought, well, maybe I'll try graphic design. And I went to this like certificate program at the University of Oregon in they have a Portland center. And I learned all about computers. Remember, this was computers and Yahoo was just starting up and there was no Google yet, I don't think. And I ran, I was interning for the woman who was running this program. There were three labs, two PC labs, a Mac lab. I mean, it was the whole thing. It was like a whole school for people to learn how to use computers and do like graphic design and learn how to build databases. And this was all new back then. This was in the 90s. I don't think, and I remember getting my first email address then too as well. And she left, and I was her intern, so I knew everything. And I convinced the powers that be that I should take her job, even though I had zero experience, but I knew everything. And they hired me, and I worked there for a year. I lasted a year, but I did a really, I feel like I did a really good job. And I actually had a staff that worked that I was in charge of. And the school, and I had some pretty crazy ideas, and some of them worked. And then I decided I wanted to go to grad school to become a poet, professional poet, to get the credentials. So I went to, I ended up going to New Mexico State, and that's where I married my first husband. You know, poets sometimes have more than one husband. So I married my first husband, and I stayed there for a year, and then. And during the second, I was studying formal poetry because I'm a big fan of formal poetry. I don't know if you know what that is, like I guess Edgar Allan Poe type stuff, or Marilyn Hacker, if you know her. More modern stuff though than more contemporary. And so I was in this class. It was like a rhyming, like a formal poetry class. And one of the it was an independent assignment. Like you need to put. Do something with one of these poems. And I was assigned a Maya Angelou poem, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to put it to music because I'm going to check out these syllables and the accent on the syllables and see if it works if I put it to music. So my husband at the time had a guitar in the closet, and I took it out, and I knew some chords like from college, but he taught me three chords in the truth. And I set this poem to music, and it worked perfectly. And I came up with my own little tune. You know, it was the first time I wrote a song. And I went into the seminar with seven other people, and I, you know, everybody else like wrote an essay or, you know, dissected it and chopped it into the poem into pieces and rearranged it. I went in and with my guitar, my husband's guitar, and I sang this poem. And all I could think was, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. Like, they're going to think I'm weird, you know? But when I was done, they were like, wow, you have a really nice voice. And I was like, wow, I never even like thought of that. But it wasn't so much that, but that was really nice. So it was a nice feedback. But when I did that, when I put that poem to music, I realized that, wow, I'm not the kind of poet that puts words on a paper. I'm the kind of poet that puts words to music. It was like this huge revelation. Like I had been writing these like rhyming poems for like, I don't know how long, like 5 or 6 years. And now they had a home in music. And so I immediately dropped out, because that's what I did. I was like, well, this is it. This is what I want to do. So I dropped out. I kind of wish I'd finished. There were moments in my life where I wish I'd finished, but now it doesn't matter anymore. And I moved back east and ended up in Brooklyn.
Just two things. Wait, Mexico. You went to New Mexico State. Is that
New Mexico State?
Yeah. Did that have a prestigious program in this? Why there?
No, they just, because it was free, and they were paying me to teach. So I also was teaching first year college students. By the way, many of whom were first generation, and English was not their first language spoken in their home. So I taught rhetoric and composition, and I really liked teaching a lot. It was kind of like performing.
And forgive me, but yeah, well, number one, you only were married to one man, right? Once?
No, I was married twice.
Now, yeah. Are you sexually fluid? Forgive me for asking, but I mean, like,
I guess. I mean, I feel like, I'm definitely attracted to women too. I mean, I would call myself bisexual. Again, these things, I don't know, you get older and it's just like, it doesn't matter. Mostly I've been with men for the most part since like my 30s. Men. But I had a long-term relationship, a couple long-term serious relationships with women in my 20s. So...
Not that, that's not, it's kind of relevant in that, I mean, well, in another way.
It, it's relevant if you're talking about like the lifestyle thing, because it's a Smith thing too, I think.
Yeah.
I think it might be a Smith thing, because there's a joke there, like Gugs, gay until graduation, like,
huh.
It's, you know, it's kind of an open playground for experimenting, you know, with, I don't know what it's like there now, but it feels like there's a lot of women on women activity going on at Smith. And I don't know if that's, I didn't go to a co-ed college, so I don't know if it's also happening at a co-ed schools, but that's kind of where I broadened my horizons at Smith. Let's put it that way.
So look, you go to Brooklyn. Is that the next destination? Is this when you decide to be a librarian?
No. So I went to Brooklyn and I was a musician for a long time. And then I actually had a trauma, like a really bad trauma, and I which I won't get into, but it kind of jarred me from this lifestyle that, as you pointed out, I had been living the bohemian lifestyle for a long time, and into my mid-30s, almost into my late 30s, like kind of just like worked, you know, hustling, really performing 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the subway tracks, gigs, like getting money for voice lessons, like on this hustling, doing a lot of posing for artists and working in restaurants, you know, things like that. And then I had this kind of trauma that, so my security always came from my art, you know, like my inner world was I won't talk about my emotional world, but my inner world, I had a very strong compass, I had a very strong connection to, I don't know, my imagination and my creativity. And that was kind of like my solid beam. And so the outside physical world, like, is like, I don't have money. Yeah. I have like a couch and I sleep on the floor or whatever. Like that didn't really seem important to me. What was important was my inner world, and that was being nurtured. And so I was fine. But then I had this trauma that shook up my inner world. And so now I'm like, oh my God, now I have no security. I have nothing. So I very quickly, well, somebody was pursuing me. It was really the first person that was pursuing me after that happened. I said, sure. He asked me to marry him. I said, sure. And we got married and I immediately got pregnant with twins. So you can imagine like me going from this other world, right? And then suddenly I'm in a marriage with two children, and the marriage was not one that was forged on, you know, ground that was, I was not really completely there when it happened. I was still suffering from this trauma and wondering, I was kind of bewildered and confused. I just knew I needed some security, and this person was offering to provide it. So in that way, it was a dependency. And that was actually ultimately what I think unraveled things, was when I discovered how dependent when I had the children, and I discovered, wow, I'm completely dependent on another human being, like me and my children. I think that's ultimately what unraveled the whole thing. And I just threw myself into, I'm going to make myself secure in this material world now. Like, I can handle this. I can do it. And so I decided to go to librarian school because I love reading. It was really nothing more than that. So I got a job where I was working from home.
Just real quick, librarian school is where? What is it? And how long does it take?
It took me 2.5 years. It takes 2 years mostly if you go full time. Took me 2.5 years.
And where was it?
Pratt. I ended up going to Pratt. I started at Queens and I moved to Pratt because while I was at Queens, the marriage fell apart and there was a commuting. I had these two small children. Pratt was a lot more expensive, but I had to move there because of the kids. Mm. Because it was closer. So now I have debt. Anyhow, yeah, that's how I ended up at library school, and the marriage ended in the middle of all this. But I finished. I thought I was going to have to drop out. I figured it out. I finished. I worked at Brooklyn Public Library for 2 years as a children's librarian, which was probably my most favorite of all daytime jobs. Of all jobs I've ever had, that was my favorite. I loved it.
Forgive me for a moment, but just talk, if you would, for 2 minutes, 90 seconds about what do you have to learn? I know about, what is it, the Dewey Decimal System, the card catalog. I mean, all that stuff. I've never, librarians, you know, shushed me and wouldn't give me the Cliff Notes that I sometimes asked for, because they had them. Did they have them at the Brooklyn Public Library? You know what I'm talking about? The actual Cliff Notes for books?
Yeah, I don't think we had them at the library, so, but I would definitely not shush you, Greg. And by the way, Brooklyn Public Library, it is so noisy in that place, especially 3 p.m. school gets out. It's like a tidal wave of kids come in there. I mean, it's like, it's not your tip. It's not like an academic library. Where it's like, shush, 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 shush.
So like, what is it all about? Like, what is being a librarian? I mean, I've not given it much consideration. You know what I mean? Like you and George, I'm sorry, George Bush's wife, I believe, was a librarian famously, like library science. What is that all about?
Yeah, library science. Well, that's, I don't even know if I can give you a good answer. It's called, the degree is Masters of Library and Information Science. So there was a lot of study, like I studied quantitative and qualitative research methods. So that was like kind of something. I studied, I took a class in user experience. I mean, library school is really like a wellspring of many, many different career paths. So user experience and information architecture, I took a class on that. And that's like how to design these massive, like Columbia University's website, for example. I did an internship at Columbia. It's massive. I mean, you click and you click and you click, like, and somebody has to design that so that it makes sense to the user. So that's one thing that library schools teach. That's, I guess, more the information side. And then there's the core courses about how to find stuff and how to classify stuff. And then like, what else did I, there's a class in academic research. That's a big one. I thought I wanted to become an academic librarian. So I took a lot of research, like how to do research, how to find stuff, the different kinds of databases. I mean, as you know, so many things are online now, but I would say like 80% of scholarly information, maybe this has changed, is in databases. You can't just look it up in Google. Like a lot of students just go straight to Google. So part of it was learning what the databases are and how to get to them. Most of them are academic. You have to have some kind of affiliation with an academic library. But part of the library school was how to convince students to use databases. And when I started working at Smith, that was part of my job, was teaching. I would work with faculty to teach students how to use the databases, because many of them just use Google. And there's LexisNexis, you know, like all ProQuest. There's all these different companies that aggregate databases. Census. I took a class on like, what's it called? Data journalism kind of class, where we had to write papers just based on data, and it was census data, government data. So that's a whole nother field, government data. I mean, my gosh, there's like so many free information places that you can gather, and journalists know about this who use data, you know, census statistics and how to use the census website. So it's actually quite complicated. It's just all about information, because there's so much, in a way, there's more information available now than ever before, and it's more accessible. But how do you parse it out, and how do you find it, and where do you go for it, and then how do you analyze it and then present it? Like, how do you go turn it from raw data into a finished product? So that's all about library school. And of course, I studied all that, and then I went and became a children's librarian, where really I didn't need any of that. But I did take I did take some public library classes, and I'm glad I did, because I ended up reading a lot of young adult novels, and I started really getting into young adult novels and reading them a lot. And that helped me as a children's librarian. I was really great at reader's advisory. That's another skill. Like when somebody comes to you and said, hey, I like this author and this author, what do you recommend? And then I could be like, oh, I would recommend this other person, because, you know, as a librarian, as a public librarian, at least you want to be reading a lot so you can recommend things to patrons. And parents with big readers really need more recommendation. I mean, these kids go through books like water. The kids I was meeting at the library, like, I've read all the Harry Potters and now I need something else. Like, so I was like constantly recommending books.
What about weird guys? And I'm serious about this, like going there to use the computer. Was that like a big, I mean, was that a what you just described sounds wonderful, but you got to get the bums off the computer and watch what they're looking at, right? Was that, and especially in the 90s, because
this was in the 90s. I was a librarian in the aughts. Yeah, But that's interesting because that was part of my, that's part of what I really liked about working in Brooklyn Public Library was the diversity and just how real it was. You know, it was, there was no, nothing precious about working at Brooklyn Public Library. I mean, you're in New York City. There's nothing precious about riding the subway, right? It's a real experience. It's just real. So yeah, definitely there were times when I had to approach people who are sleeping on the keyboard, because that's somebody else. The computers are like, there were 8 computers and they were always packed, you know, like everybody wanted to use them. There was a guy, I think he lived in his car and he would come in all day, and people looking at porn. And, you know, there's one guy, he used to come in and he would be, I'm sure he was high on dope. I mean, he would like freeze in that dope statue. Have you ever seen that? Like, I call it the dope statue or the heroin statue.
Yeah, where,
like,
they're tripping out and they're moving very slowly.
Yeah. And like sometimes they freeze. Like he would be walking and just like freeze, like half bent over. Like he'd go into a nod while he was like standing up. So he would he actually had something going on, like maybe schizophrenia. I'm not a doctor, but somehow I was always the one to go and like have the conversation with him, and have to like go through the whole land that was in his head and try to explain why he needed to get off the computer or why he needed to stop bothering these two young ladies or whatever.
Ooh.
Yeah, that I actually really liked that part though. I just really, really, and I loved the patrons, the same people coming in, the families.
And this is the big library on, it's on Eastern Parkway, oh, right, yeah, by Grand Army Plaza.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah. I didn't work at that. There's 60 branches, Greg. I worked at one of the, yeah, there's 60 branches. And so it was a big library system. The staff was diverse. The library itself was a huge bureaucracy.
Which one was yours?
Imagine. I worked at Carroll Gardens.
Huh.
Sometimes I would do extra shifts. I love that. You could do overtime at Maplewood and Borough Park. So I also worked at Maple. And sometimes did I work at the Central Branch? No, but I was there a lot for
and
meetings.
You're a city employee, right?
Yeah, I was a union employee. Free health, amazing health insurance, and it was free. Yeah, it was a good gig. And it was fun, Greg. Oh, my God, I did 4 story times a week. I would do music. All I did was play. I felt like all I did all day was, like, play with kids and families and talk to families and look at books. I mean, it was like, now, you know, you're making me want to be a children's librarian again. I wonder if BPL knows about me, like if they would hire me again. They'd probably be like, oh my God, no way, Jody Shaw. Not after what you did.
Well, there should be safeguards. There should be, it's like kind of like the civil service, right? I mean, it's a test. It's credentials. I don't think they can, they have that kind of discretion to say no, but who knows? Look, when you were,
infected now, so
you,
I don't know.
Why did you leave? It was a great gig. You're raising your kids by yourself, right?
Yeah, I was raising my kids by myself. I mean, they're seeing their dad every other weekend at that point for 3 years, it was mostly me. By the time, because we were going through a divorce, we were going through a divorce and we had actually already started thinking about moving up to Northampton. That was the thing. Like the actual plan was, in fact, we had even brought property up here. We'd come up to look because I was wanted more space. I was tired of having one is one thing, but can imagine getting a double stroller up and down the stairway,
right.
You know, there's no elevators. There's like 3 elevators in New York City for the subways. I really wonder about people in wheelchairs. Like that's really, I just can't believe it. So it was just like, I just wanted more space. And I just always remembered Northampton as such a wonderful super liberal, you know, here I am thinking about the old Northampton of the 90s. Chill and whoever you want to be, it's cool. And so we drove up here and we looked at houses just to see what the real estate market was like, and we fell in love with this house, and we ended up buying it, or he ended up buying it and renting it out. And the plan was when I finished library school we would move up here and I would get a job in an academic library. So it was kind of by a fluke that I ended up staying in Brooklyn and working as a children's librarian, because we ended up starting a divorce. And so we were staying. And so as the divorce progressed, I thought, and we were trying to figure out how can we live close enough together so that these young children can get to each. I wanted the children to have full access independently to both their parents. And I thought, well, how can we do that? You know, he was living on the Upper West Side by now in his mom's apartment on Riverside Drive. And I was in Brooklyn. You might as well be on different planets. I mean, we need a space shuttle, right? So I was like, well, you know, well, maybe one of us can rent an apartment nearby. It was the neighborhood we were living in was exploding, of course. We had bought a place in Windsor Terrace, which was, you know, it doubled in almost doubled in value in 5 years. So we're living in a hyper real estate market. The rents were exploding. And it was just, I could see it was going to be very difficult to have two households in the same neighborhood in New York City. The only reason we were getting by as it was because he was living with his mom. So I said, why don't we continue with our plan and move to Northampton? And he finally agreed to it. He said, well, yeah, if I can keep the house. So he got the house and I ended up buying another house. And we sold the house in Brooklyn for it, which was a dump, by the way. It was a postage stamp. That's part of the reason why I wanted to leave. It was a postage stamp, Greg. And the amount of money it sold for is just crazy. It's crazy.
But I'm sorry, he moves up to Northampton with you.
Yeah. So we all.
Even you're in the middle of a divorce.
No, we ended the divorce and he finally agreed to move up, and that's, we signed the papers, and then that was part of the deal. We move up here.
Oh.
So that's what we did. And so now the kids, he lives just a few blocks away from me, but not driving wise on the bike path. So you have to go on the bike path to get to him. So the kids are right near the bike path. They just get on the bike path. They walk to their dad's house two and a half blocks away. And so I felt like that would just be more secure. Like the kids are being uprooted for it. This is a vast cultural change, moving from New York City to Northampton. Let me tell you, it was a big adjustment for all of us. And including, I will say, the extreme lack of diversity. And I'm not just talking about skin color at all. I'm not even really talking about skin color at all. I'm talking about the homogenous, conformist sense here in the car culture. It's just a lot different. So there were some adjustment issues, and it was really, I felt like it was really good that they had, you know, their parents had split up, but we were both really close. I wanted them to feel like they have two homes and that they're both these homes belong to them. And I think they feel that way.
Beautiful.
We moved to Northampton.
How old are the kids?
They're 11 now.
Great, great. Yeah. So, and then you get the job at Smith right around this time, or?
Yeah, right around this time. It was like dream job. I was like, couldn't believe it. It was a temporary job, though. I was a temporary worker. And so I was up for permanent job at the same time as I was creating this extraordinary, wild and crazy experience for 600 First Years, which was the RAP, or now infamous. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Of course.
The rap I was not allowed to do because, quote, you're white. And even though I was white when I proposed the rap and they accepted it, said it was okay to do it. And I apparently was also white when I was just about to do it. And that was the reason why I couldn't do it.
So a couple things about the rap and the way it, by the way, it's been portrayed in the media whenever anyone's written about this. At least in Rolling Stone, they were like, oh, give me a break. You know what I mean? Like, they portrayed it as a ludicrous endeavor, newly ludicrous because, excuse me, white people should not be doing that. And
middle-aged white librarians, yeah.
But late. You knew what you were doing, and this was like high-end, you know, well-curated stuff that you had planned and you had done before with like great acclaim, right?
Wow, Greg, I wish we were recording our this in video because you're making me smile. I thought that. Yeah, I was like, I know what I'm doing. And in fact, my supervisor, she ended up retiring in the middle of summer, but she had a few, you know, she was a little like, I don't know about this. And so I showed her a video of something I'd done in library school. There was a contest in library school to promote this thing that students didn't know about. And I did it as a rap. I literally did it in an afternoon and I showed it to her and she said, oh, okay. She's like, now I get it. Like, I get it. You know what you're doing and this is going to be really good. And she showed it to the Dean of Libraries and Dean of Libraries was like, okay, yeah. So that's kind of how I was like, they were the only two people to really see the evidence. But yeah, I had intended for it to be successful or I would never, I don't know, I guess some people do that. But here's the thing, Greg, it doesn't really matter. Even if it had been a total cringe fest, and I'm sure there would have been students who would have been cringed out anyway. Even if it had been a total cringe fest, the whole point of the library orientation was not really, I mean, to transmit knowledge, yeah, that's part of it. But really, it's to get students to think of the library, because statistics show that if students engage with the college library in their first year, they are far more likely to continue to engage with it in their in the subsequent 3 years. So there's no way that a student going to that event would forget that there are four Smith libraries on campus, and there's this wild and crazy person named Jody Shaw who works there that I know I can go and talk to. Like, I feel comfortable with her because she did this crazy thing. So no matter how it would have turned out, it would have been successful.
No, totally, you know what makes sense. Totally, totally. Yeah. Now, just a couple of things. Yeah. Is this before or after the cafeteria incident in July? Is that...
So that was part of it. Yeah. So I started working on the wrap in the spring, late spring. And then July 31st, 2018 was when the incident happened in the dining, in the house.
And before that, though, everything is like, how would you characterize your life on campus?
It felt stiff. It felt corporate. It didn't feel like it felt in the 90s. Let's put it that way. It felt like people were kind of, and you know, I'm in the library, I'm in an academic library as opposed to a public library. It felt very stiff, very corporate. I felt like a bull in a china shop, but I just went with it. I thought, that's why they hired me. I'm an engagement librarian, so I'm just going to engage. And it also, there were like the rumblings and the messaging about whiteness and white people and the systemic racism. So that was there, but it wasn't like so in your face. I mean, after July 31st, 2018, it was like, okay, we're nailing this down now. We are on this now, and everybody's going to know about it, and everyone's going to participate. I mean, it was like, it was a hyperdrive. And so I was, you know, I was going along with it at the first year, because I thought, well, you know, I guess they must know what they're doing. I mean, we never talked about this stuff at Brooklyn Public Library, which is way more diverse than Smith College. And I thought, well, I guess these are PhDs and these are academics. You know, I never really thought about this stuff before. They must be right. You know, I guess I do have white privilege and all this. Even though inside I was like, it doesn't totally feel right. But then you're told that voice is your white privilege talking, and that voice is your inner racist or whatever. So I kind of, you know, it didn't feel right, but I had other considerations. I was trying to get a full-time job, and I was trying to do my job really well too. And I think I was doing a great job, by the way. I think I did a great job that first year at Smith. And I don't feel like that was ever fully recognized. That's not really important. But it's kind of important. And I feel part of the reason it wasn't recognized is because of this focus on race, to be honest with you.
July 31st. Can you summarize what happened that day?
Yeah, so July 31st, 2018, during the summer, classes had not started yet. There was a student worker, and who happens to be Black, and she, you know, students who living on campus during the summer, who are working on campus or just living there, are assigned to eat in specific houses. There's only one, I think, that they're supposed to eat in. And she decided that she wanted to eat in a different house. Now, the houses are used for all kinds of things during the summer. And this particular house that she chose to go in and into the dining room in happened to be in use for a summer kids camp. It happened to be a music kids camp. And so all the staff had like Corey checks and background checks. And I don't know if this student had or not, but that just goes to show you that like this, she was not supposed to be in the house. This is not an assigned house. The person working in the cafeteria happened to know who she was, recognized her, because she'd actually worked with her before. Like the student had been working in the dining room before during the school year, and kind of said something like, oh, I didn't know you were in this house. And the student flashed her ID, and the person allowed her to stay in. So the person allowed her to take some food. The student went into the dining room. I'm sorry, into the living room, which was closed. The AC wasn't even on. I mean, the living room was closed even to the campers, is my understanding, and laid down on the couch and started looking at her iPad. Well, then you have a white custodian comes along who's now, it's his job to close up the house. Lunch is over. The camp people are gone. And he sees a pair of legs on the couch. There's a lot of details in this, Greg. It's all outlined in this very thorough investigation. But long story short, the custodian did what he was instructed, which is if you see somebody who's out of place, which she was, call campus police. And that's what he did. So campus police responded. And the custodian was white, had been at Smith for a long, long time without any incident. And the student, the interaction was pleasant. The student recorded the interaction with campus police officer. The student later posted it on her Facebook page as a racial incident. And I think she used the word racist punks or something. So this exploded. And we're talking that this is her Facebook page. As far as I know, she never lodged a formal complaint with the college. So now we have the college just like completely springing into action because now this Facebook post has generated so much attention. It's gone viral. It was in The Guardian. The ACLU swoops in. The college immediately starts issuing apologies without even beginning an investigation. So acting as if it had been a racial incident. And the student herself said, yeah, this is a pattern of incidents that have occurred to me at Smith College, even though in the investigation says she did not name other examples. So the college starts announcing, we're going to implement all these programs and these mandatory anti-bias trainings and these committees and councils to combat the systemic racism while they are investigating it. So they still haven't collected all the information. So clearly we have an issue here with due process, right? Like, so we're acting as if these people are guilty. That's of racism. That's pretty strong. And the student herself has accused them on her Facebook page. And then because the student could not wanted to publicly identify the custodian who had called campus police on her and did not know who he was, she pulled out the pictures and contact info of two other employees and placed them on her Facebook page and said, here are the racist people who called campus police on me. And that was Mark Patton and Jackie Blair. Jackie Blair was the dining worker who had allowed her to stay in the dining room and had not even been, didn't even know what was going on in the living room. She had just closed up the dining room and left. And Mark Patnaud was not even, he had worked an earlier shift that day and was not even present when the incident occurred. So now you have Jackie Blair is receiving threatening notes and being whispered about and being harassed. Mark Patnaud was put on leave. That's a whole other story and never came back to the college. He had a pre-existing anxiety condition and this just blew it out of the water.
And these are working class people, by the way.
These are working class people who are not, I don't know about Mark, but I know Jackie, not highly educated. They do not have a Smith education, let's put it that way. So the college concluded the investigation and found there was no evidence of racial bias at all. And this was a thorough, if you read this report, Greg, they had video, they had audio, they had transcripts. They went back into the campus police records several years to see if there was a pattern. They really tried. They really looked. And the 70 pages of exhibits, they interviewed everybody. No evidence of racial bias. It was an outside independent investigation. And yet when the president released the findings, she said, I think a lot of people are going to have a lot of feelings about this. We're going to have a gathering. She had some gathering to process the results of the findings. And she said, and we cannot rule out unconscious bias. And so that was the single line that I guess justified the continuation of all these initiatives that she had announced during the investigation and these anti-bias trainings. And it's just the hyperdrive. So the college, in my opinion, went on continuing as if this had been a racial incident, which did not help Jackie Blair and Mark Patnaud, who had been falsely accused. And so the student actually went on to Mark Patton. I never returned, but Jackie Blair still works there and she continues to be harassed. She receives harassing notes at her residence inside her car. She gets whispered about. She was harassed by the actual student who made the accusation not this past May, but the May before. The student approached her in a dining room and said, you're the racist. Can I say biatch? You're the racist bitch who called campus police on me and everybody knows it, something like that, in a dining room. And so the college obviously they did ask the student to remove the names from the Facebook page, but they didn't discipline her. This is a violation of the student handbook policy. It's called cyberbullying. So the student was emboldened, in my opinion. And Jackie Blair filed an internal complaint, but she received a note that said, "You are racist. You do not belong on our campus. We don't want you here for our day." This was on graduation day, this graduation, a few weeks ago, she received a note. So she continues to be harassed.
She normally have been there for graduation? I mean, but this is the cafeteria worker, right?
Yes, this cafeteria worker was not even involved at all.
So I don't want you to think I'm deviating from your story, but I want to just take a moment to talk about the accuser, the original accuser, who, when I read the New York Times summary of this, which, by the way, was pretty darn good. Remember that?
That was great. Thank God for Michael Powell, yeah.
Yeah. It was Michael Powell who wrote that? Huh.
It was Michael Powell, yeah. He really did a deep dive.
So
it was great.
When you take the accuser, when I first thought about this, and as you summarized, I remember my reaction, boy, this is a really strident, you know, this is somebody looking for a problem. But let's take it from her perspective, not the incident, but where we are as a culture, like where they have been students, particularly students of color, seem culturally to be encouraged to perceive everything is racist. And like she is kind of the result of this insane conversation, movement, moment that we're having, even though it's 3 years ago. But I don't know, like more and more I think about it, I'm blaming her less. Does that make sense?
Yes. I was just going to say that, like, you know, people, I'm all for self-responsibility. I think that's part of the problem of this ideology, is that does not teach and it's not empowering. And it also, the flip side of that is there's a lot of total lack of responsibility. But so I'm all for responsibility, but I have never felt like the student is really responsible for this. I really feel the college in teaching this stuff, that this is a micro, everything's about race and it's a microaggression, is doing a great disservice to students. And the way the college handled this only emboldened her to believe that this was a racial incident. And that is a disservice to her. She is paying, the college has a fiduciary responsibility to these students. They are paying at a highly sensitive developmental stage, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. They're paying this college, who's now engaging in co-curriculums about social justice. I mean, they're there for an education. The college has decided they also need an education in social justice. So, I think arguably there is a case to be made for tools, you know, through the residence life department, tools to deal with conflict or modeling good nonviolent communication or whatever trauma-informed response, however you want to couch it. The college has decided to focus on social justice and this microaggression stuff, where it's not about intent. You never try to like put yourself in the other person's shoes and figure, oh, well, maybe he was just doing his job, or, and what's my part in this? Well, gee, maybe this house was not open to me. You know, maybe I am out of place. There's none of that. There's none of this, like trying to actually work through issues and put yourself in the other person's shoes, called empathy, and take responsibility for your part in it. There's none of that. So the co-curriculum is completely devoid of anything that I think is actually going to be useful towards entering society and being a responsible, effective communicator, and which, you know, in a healthy society. And it's all about this like very unhealthy, toxic race, you know, instant racism. Like it was a racial incident. And not only that, I mean, it's one thing to like look at somebody, like racism is something you do and you can prove it. Yeah, I did that because that person has different skin color than me. That's why I did it. That's clearly racism. But like, to think that it's something unconscious and the custodian was unconscious of it and had this implicit thing going on and we have to rout that out. I mean, the whole thing is just crazy. And so I definitely don't blame the student. And when that, I mean, I blame her a little bit, but because I don't think all students buy into this. That's the other thing. But when that New York Times article came out, there were a lot of students who, because I go on the Smith Confessional where the students anonymously post stuff, they were talking about this student like, and they were being mean, you know? Mm. And so I actually posted something on there and said, hey, you know, look, if you're going to leave Umu alone, if you're going to blame anybody, blame Smith College. Because they really, they created this Petri dish in which these things are now occurring. And they, not only that, but they then added fuel to the fire. by acting as if it had been a racial incident without any evidence, and the student didn't even file a formal complaint. I mean, Greg, I could go on. It's a very upsetting thing because so many people were harmed, and the college only seemed to focus on the quote unquote harm caused to the student and the community of color that was so harmed by this, when really we have actual material harm that we can see with our eyeballs that occurred to these employees.
So another quick observation, and that because so much money was spent on that report, obviously they brought a law firm in, I presume, looking at all that stuff.
A lot of money. Yeah.
Now I understand that there is an immediate conscious concern about cancel culture and, oh my God, we don't want to appear racist and we've got to get to the bottom of that. And that I can, you know, people say that stuff and think that stuff. But I want to just entertain for a moment that the overreaction is based on a different type of fear, a fear that was like documented and talked about and which is a fear that white people, some of them, have of black people. There is, it was talked about in the early aughts a lot. From the 80s to the 90s and the early aughts. And Michael Moore was brilliant. I don't like that guy anymore, but he, in Bowling for Columbine, no, he just strung together all of this media footage of, you know, local news reports and national news reports, like over-dramatizing crime and
I wish highlighting... you would do that now for, like, Black Lives Matter.
Now it's probably appropriate, but, like, now, like, highlighting the role of black men committing crimes. Like, you know, it was a black man, and
right.
Like it was overdone, and there are lots of people know, people talked about it. There was a movie called Soul Man. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It was James Earl Jones, and this guy pretends to be black to get into Harvard Law School. It's a major Hollywood motion picture.
Oh yeah, I think I saw that.
Right. And he gets on an elevator and he notices that, you know, people are, you know, like women grab their purses and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. This was a thing. And now, like, did that, I should probably stop and organize this better, but is that latent, not so latent, is that fear still there? They are on some primal level afraid of this girl or Stacey Abrams when she comes into Coca-Cola's office. You know, are they afraid not just of the political power and the culture, the woke mob, but literally afraid? Which, because they were literally afraid not too long ago. That probably doesn't make sense.
I don't know, Greg. You might be onto something. I mean, because if you think about it, I've been thinking about this a lot. It feels like race, first of all, has been reduced, quote unquote, the discussion about race has been reduced to a binary. Like, race is now a binary. Race is not a binary. There's all different kinds of races, if you even believe in the concept of races, right? Like, which we've agreed that we do, I guess. There's like this anti-black racism. It's a very specific discussion, it seems like to me. I don't hear a lot. I mean, we've heard some anti-Asian stuff recently, but at Smith, it seemed like it wasn't about a discussion about race. It was a discussion about white people and black people. And I don't know. I can't say if there's something deeper going on there, but I do know that we do have impulses, right, that are tribal, and that's a human or an animal thing. Who knows? Maybe it's a chimp thing. And that those impulses are, in a healthy culture, a healthy society, get sublimated, I guess. And it depends on if there's the Freudian definition of sublimation, there's the Jungian one. We won't get into that rabbit hole. But like, we sublimate them, or we temper them, or we channel them, that's a better word, into behaviors that are socially beneficial. They're outlets, right? Sports. That's a great example. You have a team, the in-group and the out-group. They're basically the tribes, right? Like, and you're going to compete. It's a power thing. And that's how we transmute this, I guess. I don't know. We channel it into healthy avenues. And so that's why these things are so important. Sports are so important. I think we don't pay enough attention to how important these cultural outlets actually are. And so I do think that, like, by focusing instead, by kind of destroying these cultural outlets and then going back to the tribal stuff, which is what this, I think this is, this race, this focus on race, it does bring out unhealthy stuff. And I don't know about that connection to fear, but the in-group, out-group stuff, we are now emphasizing that. We're now separating children out by race and saying, you need a special group for yourselves. We're separating students as we're going to have a house just for Black students. We're now emphasizing that, but not in the healthy way that we do, say, with, like, when we have a sports competition, because there's still power drives there. There's power drives there. Let's admit it. And now we're breaking people down by skin color. And now it's starting to get really ugly. And to me, this is a very, very dark, dark, dark place we're headed, because those power stuff and those dark stuff doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Does that?
Yeah, no, what you said is totally. But look, just to put a button on my problematic, probably, observation, I didn't even see that movie Soul Man. I was in the late 80s. I was working at Bloomingdale's, and I was crazy about this woman who happened to be Jamaican. Her name was Suzette, and we never dated or anything, even though I really wanted to. She told me to watch this movie, and that really... defines, like, her experience. And I remember just seeing the trailer, and this guy gets on an elevator, and the white women grab their purses and that kind of thing. And it just, it stayed with me that, like, that's actually happening. She was telling me that's a real thing.
Yeah.
And I remember I was I don't really remember where I was politically, but I disputed that, and in part because I came from a diverse, I grew up in a diverse community, at least until, like, second grade. And I think that has a lot to do with your kind of your outlook and your comfort level, where you actually grew up the first 7 years. It was a diverse community. Then we moved to a 1,000% white community. And so anyway, I'll leave that alone.
No, I think you're right. I have heard that too. And that, you know, the catching a cab thing, I think that's a real... I've heard that from several people when I was in New York. I can't catch a cab, you know.
Well, most of the cab drivers are people of color.
I know. Isn't that interesting?
And, you know, I heard Denzel Washington talk about this. No, Barack Obama, actually, to prove his... I remember people were questioning his blackness in 2008.
But I wonder... Sorry, yeah, because he's half white, right?
And he cited that as, like, you know, well, when I try to get a cab in Manhattan.
That's hard to believe because, yeah, I mean, I imagine a black man wearing a suit is going to have a different impression than, you know, black person with wearing baggy clothes. And I mean, we have our stereotypes, and I mean, it's not necessarily about the skin color. It's not all about the skin color.
Whenever you mention that, it's like, I just think right away, I take a cab. It depends what month it is. Sometimes I get really stingy. I'm like, I'm not taking cabs this month. And then I just go, anyway, I haven't had a white cab driver in a very long time.
So, yeah, I don't think I've ever had a white cab driver. Maybe one from, like, Ukraine or something.
All hell breaks loose on campus. You are shut down from the rap, and you're actually vying for a promotion, and things get very chilly at the library, and you make a change, right?
Chilly, yeah.
No, I mean, in their treatment.
Well, I left. I withdrew my application from the job I was up for. I felt some humiliation and shame, actually, too, because, like, here I was like, oh, this thing you're doing is, like, culturally inappropriate. So I left and I took a job that was, like, I thought was under the radar kind of thing. Like, I took a pay cut to take this other job and accepted that. And I thought, well, and I'm a job where I'm no longer teaching, no longer doing anything programmatic. Nuts and bolts, making keys, getting ID cards, helping students change rooms. I was working with students who had, you know, special accommodations. But I was mostly providing admin support for the department, which was working more on the curricular stuff, the social justice stuff. But I didn't realize just how infused with social justice the residence life department was until I got there. And even after I got there, I thought, well, okay, that they're super into this stuff, but I'm admin support. So obviously, like, I don't have to be in it. Like, I'm just doing stuff that's clearly unrelated to race and clearly has nothing to do with any of this stuff, with social justice. It's very nuts and bolts. But lo and behold, I was expected to participate. I was expected to participate in meetings where we talked about our own identities and to talk about Smith in general and to process these things and to help support and create a curriculum, a co-curriculum for students that was heavily, involved and heavily influenced by this notion of like oppressed and oppressor and victim oppressor without that's and that privilege is inherent entirely to skin color, you know, and nothing else. And the whole notion of intersectionality is really interesting, but I always felt like my colleagues, it just felt like everything was very reductive and watered down and very jargony. And it felt like there were often times when I felt like, wow, like we're doing this co-curriculum that's about race and race. Like there's so many nuances and so much going on here. And they've managed to flatten it out to this jargony, two-dimensional cardboard cutout that I think, and it's very destructive and divisive. And I just felt like I didn't want to, just felt like it was wrong, and I didn't want to participate in it, and it felt like it was disempowering to students. So yeah, I took that job and I jumped into the frying pan, basically. Is that how you put it? Jumped out of the frying pan into the fire, or whatever that saying is. Yeah,
and then they enroll. But the job itself, though, you're opening doors for people. I mean, keys. You're doing the mechanics of the job well. Is there friction in that?
Yeah, there started to become more and more friction because I was reluctant and I had started questioning things. They gave me a book called Teaching for Social Justice. I read this book and it was highly academic and theoretical. And I thought, have any of my colleagues actually read this book? Because this is like, this stuff is, you know, very first line was about equal allocation of resources or something. That was the first line in defining social justice. And I thought, do they understand what that means? I'm thinking, wow. Well, my supervisor, like, she just built a house. Like, do you know what equal allocation of resources actually means? Like, in real practical terms. Like, I always go straight to the practical. Like, I like to think about theories a lot, but I'm like, well, what does that mean in the real world? And so I approached my supervisors and I talked to both of them, and within 5 minutes, separate conversations, each one of them says, I don't actually think about this stuff that much. I'm not kidding you not, Greg. And yet they were so invested in this being the thing, the social justice thing. So I just lightly questioned it. I kind of hung back. I didn't use my pronouns. I didn't like volunteer information at these meetings. And I think I started to become kind of suspect, you know, cause you do, that's the other problem. Like, you can't just not participate. Cause after a while it's like, why isn't this person participating? And then it did reach ahead when I went, it did in fact go to a meeting. And I remember I showed my supervisor a Jonathan Haidt video that was really great about anti-fragility. I don't know if you know about that concept. Like, for students, I said, maybe we should approach, you know, the curriculum through the lens of anti-fragility. You know, you break a bone and it doesn't just heal, it grows back more bone. And giving students, like, approaching the curriculum that way, like an empowering. And she watched the video and she's like, but there's no social justice in it. And I thought, oh my God. So then it finally got to the point where I decided, you know, I'm not comfortable discussing my race at work. And mostly it was focused on race. And I decided if you can't ask me about my race during a job interview, I'm not going to talk about my race during the job either. I don't think it should be a continued condition of my employment either.
Wow.
And so I didn't say that, but I thought that, I realized that to myself, and that made me feel a little strong. And by the way, another staff member, a custodian, had written an open letter to the Northampton Gazette or the Hampshire Gazette, and they didn't publish it, but it was published by the Springfield Republican originally. And it was very shortly after that July 31st, 2018 incident, kind of telling the college, like, look, you really mismanaged this, and now you've created a culture of fear and hostility on campus. The college ignored that. So that letter, I found that letter during this time, because I started really, there were a number of things happening on campus, Greg, too. I mean, this is all my, actually, it's not all my complaint. Like, there was the police officer responded to that was terminated. 35 years, spotless work record, beloved fixture on campus. He was terminated. Many staff believe it was because of he was the face of this incident and the college wanted to get rid of him. Who knows? Undisclosed reasons, he's not talking. Another police officer who had just been hired was, I guess, amicably parted ways, quote unquote, after 2 months, within 48 hours of the students posting tweets of his that he had tweeted out all over campus and demanding that he be fired. So he was gone. So there are demands taped to my door by students saying, we're going to make you feel our pain. You know, it was, they were taped to everyone's door, but if our demands aren't met, we'll make you feel our pain. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you could make me feel your pain. You know, you just all these people, staff, other staff members I've seen suffer real consequences because of student accusations. Yeah. I took that as a serious threat.
Mm-hmm.
And the college didn't once reach out to staff and say, you know, don't worry. There was never any of that. It was all about the students. And see, this is how we embolden students, right? The college immediately capitulated to some of the demands. You know, just the whole, it's just like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I had started thinking about all this and said, I'm not, this is wrong. This is just wrong. And so when I was expected to go to this mandatory retreat where I knew we would be discussing our race, I went to my supervisor and I said, I'm not comfortable discussing my race at work. And she said, no problem. Just say that. So I went to the retreat and I said that. And that was the line when the facilitators shortly afterwards said, I was the only one to do that, by the way. They said, we want to be clear that any white person who expresses discomfort when asked to discuss their race is not actually experiencing discomfort. What they're showing is their white fragility, and that's a power play. So they effectively framed my genuinely expressed discomfort as an act of aggression. And so that was the line for me. I was like, okay, now, and I felt shame. I felt shame when they said that in front of my colleagues.
By the way, are there any black people in these meetings? There are. Okay.
Yes. And the conversations are always very scripted and, you know, there's a script.
So what happens next?
So they said that and I thought, okay, that's it. That's the line. I felt horrible. Felt absolutely horrible. I don't think I went to work. I probably didn't go to work the next day. I can't remember. And I filed a complaint. I said, okay, now we've crossed the line where I can't even abstain without being even my abstinence is seen as some kind of act of racial aggression. So I went to file the complaint, and the person who has a JD and who's responsible for enforcing the EEOC, you know, regulations or laws, and who processes complaints of racial harassment, hostility, listened to my story. You know, I talked about what happened in the library. There's emails, there's documentation. They don't deny any of this happened. And she looked at me, she was like incredulous, I think. And she said, you know, she said, do you believe in white privilege? And then she said, sorry, I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh. This is.
No, it's incredible. It's coming from a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if she was barred, but she was definitely a JD, had a law degree and specifically worked in this area. Right. And then she said, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was created to protect traditionally marginalized groups of people. So I can't, you know, looking back, I'm like, was she trying to discourage me? I mean, clearly, maybe somebody else might have been discouraged and said, well, and felt bad because I didn't file a complaint about the rap precisely for this reason. I didn't think, not only did I think it wouldn't be taken seriously because it was coming from a white person, I thought if I file a complaint and people find out a white person filed a complaint, which they will find out, I'll never get a job here.
By the way, what kind of complaint is it? Is it an HR complaint? Is it like a complaint?
No, it's an EEOC. It's a
An actual federal form that you filled out.
No. No, it's in organizations have internal EEOC compliance officers.
Okay.
So whatever the process was, it was like a, it was an informal. I wrote it up. It was almost 80 pages. I had to write it up. Yeah, and then the last thing she said to me was, if you proceed with this complaint, I will need to hire an outside investigator. And I said, well, I thought you were the person that that did the complaints. And she said, yes, but this is different because you're white. So there were three statements made to me to indicate that this was going to be handled differently because I'm white.
Wow.
So I did the complaint anyway, and the internal complaint ended, you know, by the then. Okay, so here's the kicker. Right when I filed the complaint, George Floyd was killed.
Oh,
so
boy.
Then the campus went into racialized overdrive. Everything. I mean, just everything. Like, we're having meetings just for white people. We're having a generating justice event. We're having this 4-page document about Rachel Justice Smith. We're going to engage in this and that. We're going to do all these committees, and we're going to have this and that. In the middle of a global pandemic in which people are being told they're going to get furloughed. The college is now saying, yes, there's probably going to be furloughs. And, you know, as we undertake financial considerations, of primary importance will be our commitment to this, these new plans for achieving racial justice at Smith, or combating racial, you know, so that kind of language. So as a staff member, it was like, wow, I might get furloughed, and I can see where the priorities are here. Even though there's not going to be any students on campus, we're still going to proceed with this. Either we're like 100 students on campus, I think, that fall.
Does word get out about your complaint? You were furloughed.
I was put on a half furlough. I was the only member of my department put on a half furlough, yeah.
And does word get out about this?
Well, I don't, yeah. I mean, I think people in my department knew I had filed a complaint because they were named. Some of them were named in the complaint. My supervisor certainly knew about it. I told them I was filing a complaint. And then as things got worse, I started writing HR and the person investigating the complaint. I said, look, I just filed a complaint about this racially hostile environment we have going on, and individual acts of racial hostility that have been occurred, have been, that I have been subject to. And now things are getting worse. Now you're going to hyperdrive now. I'm being invited to all these white only meetings and all this stuff. And I'm like, now like I'm being told like there's going to be an equity evaluation of pay structure. Like, what does that mean? Like, and my performance is going to be evaluated on this and that. So I started like realizing like, wow, they're not taking this complaint seriously. I ended up writing to the members of the college, the president's cabinet, as a kind of a Hail Mary. I said, look, I met with the Office of Equity Inclusion, where I was asked him to define what's equity. What do you mean by equity? What does this stuff mean? And he suggested that I read Ibram X. Kendi. And he sent me Layla Said's essay, Me and White Supremacy.
Wow.
Even though I made it clear, I said, I don't want you to send me stuff about my race and about how I harbor white supremacy, or I'm in any way have some privilege, or I don't, now I see this as this is real harassment now. It didn't matter. I wrote the email, nothing. So that's when I decided I had to make a video, and it was the nuclear option. I knew I might have to do it. I did not want to do it, Greg, because it was very scary. I felt I was very alone. I had other people at the college I talked to about this who felt like this stuff was crazy. I didn't know if they would stand up with me or not. I knew that these employees had been harmed, and that was part of the larger story. And I finally got to a point where I had to do it, and I did it. And I ended up losing contact with many of the people who I'd been speaking to before. They didn't end up standing up with me. But you know, it opened a whole nother world to me. And then I was immediately put on, like less than a month later, I was put on under investigation, a paid leave for about 2 months while they investigated. It was emails I'd forwarded to myself. The emails were about me, to be clear. They were sent to the college about me, and I was forwarding them to myself as documentation.
Did you get a lawyer?
Yeah, I had a lawyer. I'd hired a lawyer over the summer as a consultant to help me with this internal complaint process. And then I ended up hiring a different lawyer when I could see that this was going to be very, very public. And I needed a lawyer who was experienced, not only experienced with public cases and publicity, but also was comfortable with me going out and being public and didn't feel like, oh, you can't say anything. Because I knew that was, I knew that in the David and Goliath story, I had to analyze what does the college, where are the weak spots? They don't like publicity. Yeah, I had to have something to leverage because I tried very hard to talk to them. I tried very hard. I went through all internal remedies. I thought, okay, now I'm going to have to think. They don't like publicity, so I'm going to go there. And the next thing is, I don't think they're going to like discovery. I'm not going to like discovery either, but.
But at this point, you haven't filed a lawsuit. I mean, like, so what, like.
No, at this point. Yeah, at this point it's still with the EEOC, the state EEOC.
And when you say leverage, like what do you like at this point you got to realize, okay, my career at Smith is over no matter what happens, right? Or not so much.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I thought probably it was going to be over. I thought they were going to fire me for something. Yeah, I mean there's no way. Over constructive discharge, let's put it that way, because it grew so hot. It was hostile before I made the video. You can imagine what it was like after.
And when you say like you didn't want discovery, you would be afraid of discovery. Like, is that, I mean, everybody.
That's why I made the rap. Well, I don't know if you saw the rap, but yeah, discovery is horrible.
Oh, you mean like, discovery is horrible. Like everybody has stuff they don't want out there, right?
Yeah. And they're going to go for that because they've already admitted to everything they've done. They're not denying they did any of this stuff. So now they have to defend it. So, I mean, the only avenue what's going to attacking my credibility that people do that all the time in litigation. And so I imagine that that's what they're going to do. There's going to be any little Easter eggs they can insert about me and my past, and I do have a past, you know, I'm almost 50 years old. That's not a pleasant thought. And this is a highly public case. There's a lot of eyeballs on me. And so, you know, it's like, wow, everybody's going to know all this stuff if they go there, which I'm sure they will. And so that's partly why I made the rap. I ended up doing the library rap. I ended up releasing it, and in between the original library rap portions, I wrote recent verses, and the recent verses are about my situation with Smith College and basically saying to people, look, they're going to try to say really crappy things about me. And I do have a past. I have used drugs. I do have a mental health history. I say all that in the rap. And I felt like it was really important that it come from me first, because I think people see me on the screen as this sweet, well, you saw the hipster in me, but most people see this really sweet middle-aged woman, this honest, sincere person who I am. But I felt like it was really important to flesh myself out. I didn't want Smith College to do it. It needed to come from me, and it needed to come from me in a form that I feel comfortable with, which is music.
This is awesome.
So that's why it was a perfect opportunity. I thought, well, I'll just release the, since people were like, release the rap. I thought, well, I will. And I'll say some other things while I'm at it.
It's kind of like Eminem and 8 Mile. Remember that at the end?
Oh my God, Greg.
What?
Yes. that's exactly it. I rewatched the movie. I said, you know, Eminem did that. I rewatched the movie and I thought, I'm going to do that. You're like, I feel like we're vibing here.
That's so cool.
Exactly like Eminem.
What year were you born?
71. When were you, 69?
68, December of 68.
So we're Gen X. I think Gen X is a big hope here.
Were you ever fired? Were you fired? Were you formally fired or did you quit?
From Smith?
Yeah.
No. I was constructively discharged. I was not formally fired. I left because could no longer work there. Especially after I was put under investigation and it was so hostile. There was no way. I did entertain going. I turned down a settlement, and then it was like, okay, I guess it was kind of a game of chicken, I guess. Okay, I guess you come back to work. And I thought really hard about it. I thought, well, if I go back, I can continue to fight from the inside. But I thought about my mental health by that point, Greg, was severely compromised. I was not in good shape. Let's put it that way. And I felt like going back to an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
Especially at that point, it was so hostile and so public. And so my colleagues had complained that they felt like I was harming them. I mean, these are people I work with, you know, I mean, it was untenable for me.
I'm so sorry. And when work goes south, that is, it's the worst thing. It's terrible. And it can really exacerbate a mental health situation. So your lawyer,
well, to be clear,
yeah,
my mental health was good when I got to Northampton.
Sure.
Pretty good, you know.
Yeah, no, I, all right. So I guess I want to say what happens next, or is it like, where do things stand now, or what happens next and where do things stand now?
Yeah, so I may release the rap because I started thinking a lot about, because I obviously, as you know, I haven't been podcasted to death. I've been privileged and honored to be interviewed on many podcasts. So I want to reframe that. I make that clear. And talked about this a lot, and also talked about it a lot. Like, so many people have reached out to me, Greg. I can't even tell you. Like, people who are alone, there's nobody, they can't talk to anybody at their work because you can't talk about it. So I've been talking to a lot of people just like myself who are in these situations. And I realized two things. One, these people need help. They need money, because in this country, as opposed to like the UK, when people stand up and say something, it often ends up that they get fired, because we have a lot of at-will employment going on here. And they might have a case, but they don't even have money to hire a lawyer, let alone get through the few months so they can find a job. So people need help. They need other people to talk to. And that's why I work with Counterweight. They have a community-based model, which, you know, they have a Discord server, and we now have listening sessions where people can talk to each other, because they need to work out. It's kind of like being in a cult almost. Like, you need to work out that you're not necessarily racist. You're not a bad person for thinking maybe something's wrong here. That requires discussion, ongoing, regular discussion with other human beings to work that out. And you don't get that in that work environment where it's like, it's kind of like you're being gaslighted. So community and money. And so I realized those two things. So I'm actually, and the other thing I realized is that the CRT discussion / argument, trying to convince, this is an attack on enlightenment values. Logic, reason, and evidence are no longer valid tools to people who are invested in ideology. Why? Because they are grounded in, they are white supremacists. That's just the short way of putting it. And so if you're using logic, reason, and evidence to try to suss out this ideology and try to maybe persuade somebody or even be convinced by them, let's be frank, maybe they have a point. You can't, because if the other party's not using logic, reason, and evidence, you cannot communicate. You literally cannot. If we've agreed to use these tools as a society, and now one party's not using them anymore, how do you communicate? How do you evaluate each other's points? You can't. And so I've decided we can talk until we're blue in the face. So I've started, but it's not going to get us anywhere. I can see that clearly. Maybe it will. We still need the essays and we still need the podcast very much. I've started focusing more on the what somebody termed the load-bearing aspects of culture. The outlets that I mentioned before, the sports, the comedy, the art, the music, these things are also suffering. They're starting to get destroyed by identity politics. And those are our healthy outlets. If we can fortify and build those, then I really think, because those are alternative ways for people to connect with each other without having to use logic, reason, or evidence. When you go to a ball game and you're rooting for your team and you're getting your yayas out, you don't know who the person next to you voted for. You just know you're rooting for the same team. That's a glue. These other parts of culture are a glue that hold us together in non-political ways. And so those, I feel like if we can, this is a more positive instead of, this is like a more of a pull than a push. If we can make those things strong, I think we can pull people together in non-political ways. And also, frankly, if we can just make stuff cool again, I think people who are miserable and like so invested in this ideology, I think a lot of them are frankly miserable. And I think if they say, wow, those people look like they're having a lot of fun over there. You know, that's the pull. That's my pull theory. Like they'll be like, you know, maybe I actually just want to like have a good life and like be with people and have fun with them and not worry about what their skin color is and all this stuff. And we can still have those conversations, and we can probably have them in a better way if we're being friendly in other ways and we have these other, this other glue. So I'm actually, this is a long way, and that's kind of why I released the wrap. It was part of trying to encourage other creatives to make something that you can tap your foot to, even if you don't necessarily like agree with it. It wasn't really ideological, the wrap. It was just more fun and music, and there's a lot there, I guess. But so I'm starting an organization, Greg. I'm sorry, I'm very verbose, but I'm starting an organization to help people with very practice, to help defend civil liberties and to promote, to advance integrity and in all its forms. And that is to provide money to people, to help connect people with lawyers, and to provide money to artists and comedians and people who are building, who are doing, creating cultural artifacts and cultural events and engaging people in non, in polite ways, in deeper, more meaningful ways.
Does it have a name yet?
It does, but and I
you don't want to, yeah, you can't put it out yet.
We're in the process of incorporating, so I want to wait.
Are things settled with Smith, or is it ongoing?
It's ongoing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's still at the MCAD.
Right. Now, just a couple of things. The letter they put out about you is so, I think, self-incriminating for Smith. I want to emphasize, this is a letter they put out to kind of embarrass you and their response. And I want to emphasize, this
Which
is from
one?
The president put it out. I guess, what's the date on this? I don't have the date, but I have a picture of it. I want to emphasize that Smith College remains unyielding in its commitment to advancing racial justice, a commitment that includes and benefits every member of our community. Like, this is from a legal standpoint, this is junk. This is junk science. Like, and they're endorsing it, and they're kind of like a doubling down on this nonsense. But when you see it in black and white, and they're responding to you and your very real claims, research demonstrates the continued presence of systemic discrimination against people of color across all areas of society. Redressing the reality of racism requires asking ourselves how we might even inadvertently reinforce existing inequalities or contribute to an exclusionary atmosphere. This is the kind of stuff that before a judge, I mean, in a real courtroom, would be like, this, I think, is very problematic, this letter. Does your side sense that, or am I misinterpreting?
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost like, what does that have to do with me?
Yeah.
I'm almost like, okay, great. And we can debate whether or not that's true, but it's almost like that not, doesn't have anything to do with, like, you violated my civil rights.
And
period.
I guess this is like they're admitting, like, this is unorthodox stuff. This sounds like gobbledygook. There's not, this is just feel good stuff that was invented 10 minutes ago. You know, this kind of language.
I know, right?
And this is their official response. So I think they're in trouble personally. But all right. So I just have a couple
I
more.
I think they are too. I think they just kept digging and digging and digging. You know, it would have meant, this would be a different story, maybe, I think, if Kathy McCartney had seen my video and said, oh, I should reach out to her.
Yeah.
You know, different story.
Right.
All the, she's talking about, we need authentic conversations and we need to have these hard discussions. Well, then I think you should have one with me. And actually, I don't know which letter, there were actually a few letters, but the first one after my video, I actually still had an open heart at that point. I always have an open heart, Greg. I'm a liberal, but I took it as an invitation, even though it was kind of a diss. I said, look, I'm going to take this as an invitation. I'm going to respond in a video, and I hope Kathy McCartney will respond in kind. And she didn't, so. But this would be a different story if she actually did want to have an authentic conversation. A
couple of quick things. How do you spend your days? Like, what is your day structure like now?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I'm on the computer so much. I do so much back end stuff that, and I want to be doing more front end. By back end, I mean
the drudgery of setting this stuff up.
Yeah, well, setting the stuff up, but also just responding to people in situations and trying to help them find a lawyer, trying to connect people, other people who are starting organizations, just because now this happens a lot with whistleblowers, like, that, you know, have a presence now, like everyone kind of flocks to them and writes to them and says, I need this. Can you connect me with this person? And it, you know, now I can connect them to this person because I know the person. And so there's a lot of that. There's a lot of me trying to set up this organization, working, collaborating with others that didn't work out. Not because we didn't want it to, but because of legal issues. So I've been trying to start an organization for quite a while now. And then of course, all the interviews and stuff, and then creating the rap, that took up a lot of time. And, now I'm really focused on creating this organization. I'm still helping people, connecting. I'm trying to make some art. That's important to me. And I'm also going to be, for all my talk of podcasts, I'm also starting a podcast with my friend Jenny Holland. She lives in Northern Ireland. So that's the UK, technically, for everybody out there. We are going to have a podcast, and it is going to be a little different from, we're not going to be talking about this stuff per se. We're going to be doing, we're going to have a much broader net in terms of the people we talk to and the things we talk about. So that's all I can tell you right now. We're going to start taping soon.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be really great. It's going to be people from all over the political spectrum and like real outliers. Like, we're both a big fan of like these kind of independent outlier type people that can't really be boxed, you know?
Yeah. No,
like yourself, you might be a good guest, Greg.
Well, I think something amazing is coming from this nasty incident in her life, something really great, something that can help a lot of people. Please go to jodyshaw.net for more information, JodiShaw. And I hope to be hearing more from her in the future. Many, many thanks for listening. I'll see you on Newsmax at Greg Kelly USA on Twitter. All the best. Thanks so much. Hey, that was one hell of a talk, right? 2 hours? I'm going all Joe Rogan on you guys, huh? I don't know. Look, it's totally different than the way I would conduct a television interview. It's totally different. It's kind of indulgent for me. I just, anything that I want to know, I ask. With, forgive me, little regard if it's of immediate concern or interest to a mass audience. It's kind of my theory about all this is that, well, look, when I listen to a podcast, I love listening to two people talk because, let's face it, we're not having conversations like we used to. I used to talk on the phone all the time, all the time. Now, I talk to my parents. And I talk to my brother. And when I talk to them, I'm usually looking at Twitter, which is awful. It's something I've got to stop. But I don't talk to my friends anymore on the phone. And I don't think I'm alone that way. You just can't call the way that we used to. Anyway, so these kinds of conversations, when I listen to them on other podcasts, there's a vicarious kind of pleasure in listening to two people converse. And so there's that. And also for me, just getting all of these things and not having to worry about commercial breaks and not necessarily worrying about whether or not it's sensational or, you know, fascinating or, you know, I mean, it's all fascinating to me, but it doesn't have to be outrage, 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 and that kind of thing. A totally different tempo from the other stuff I do, and I really enjoy it. So I hope you do as well. And that's it for now. Many thanks. Take care.